Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie. This is The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Today, I'm joined by Reason's print edition magazine editor-in-chief, Catherine Mangu Ward. Catherine, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Nick. Thanks.
And with Matt Welch, by Matt Welch, editor-at-large of Reason. Matt, thanks for talking to us today as well.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start by talking about the Trump's executive order banning immigration from certain countries and refugees from various countries for a certain period of time. Matt, do you want to give us a quick overview of what his executive order actually did?
Yeah, there's a lot of confusion about this, partly because the order was written confusingly and the administration has done some back and forth on this, but also just because it's so comprehensive and such a change of direction. So short answer is all refugees are banned from the country for 120 days. So that's everyone. If you're getting genocided in the face, if you're a Yazidi, if you're a Christian, if you're a Muslim, if you're from any country, not just seven, you cannot come into the United States via the refugee program that we've had established since 1980 for the next 120 days minimum, although Trump administration has said that they plan on reinstituting it. And that during that timeout, they are going to establish what they have described as extreme vetting, and then on a case-by-case basis will be restarting the refugee program. They also, when they restart that refugee program, will reduce the annual target of refugees from 110,000 was supposed to be the number this year that Barack Obama set, to 50,000. During the Obama administration, it was more or less hovering around 75,000. During George W. Bush, it was much lower than I think it averaged even less than 50,000. But prior to that, in Clinton and Reagan and H.W. Bush, we resettled many more refugees than all of that per year. So this is a pretty radical limitation of refugees, and certain, you know, people who boarded planes as legal refugees who would jump through the hoops because there are plenty of hoops to jump through. Found themselves detained in airports and in some cases sent back to their countries of origins, even after doing everything.
So it's not just refugees, though, too. Talk about the seven countries that are targeted for immigration purposes.
So the seven nation army of miserables, Iraq, Iran, Sudan, Somalia, Syria, a couple others. Yemen, I think. So all people from those countries, with the exception of diplomats, are banned from entering the U.S. for the next 90 days. And then that will be looked at again later on. Syria, this is adds to kind of the confusion of it. Refugees from Syria are banned indefinitely. There's a feeling of like, we can't figure that out. So until we do, your refugees can't come. But in the meantime, anyone from those countries can't come. Adding to all of this is there's the green card confusion. At first, and over the objections of the Department of Homeland Security, the Trump administration insisted that U.S. legal permanent residents, people who live here and got the green card and got interviewed and went through vetting and have biometric entry data and all this kind of stuff, if they were outside of the country and they tried to get in, they were also affected by this ban. This has led to a lot of anguish in particularly Iranian American community and elsewhere. Also, those people, that ban, the 90-day ban, applied to them in case they wanted to leave the country. They have since, under public pressure, walked that back, although I think we're still waiting to see whether the implementation works. And I would add another category to this that doesn't getting a lot of play, which is that people who are dual nationals emanating from those seven countries. So let's say, for example, you were born in Iran, but then became a refugee, or you resettled to Paris and got French citizenship, but you're still a dual French Iranian citizen. You cannot enter the United States for the next 90 days minimum here. This will add a lot of stress to a further stressed visa waiver program under which normally citizens from those countries can travel here without having to get a visa for up to 90 days. So that's the state of play right now with what the entire set of executive orders looks like. Again, the implementation is very confusing, and there's been a lot of legal stays on this, and it's unclear to what extent the administration and the Commission for Border Patrol is actually enforcing the legal orders or defying them. So there's a lot of different things that we're have still yet to shake out.
So, Catherine, what is your reaction to this? Because this is also something that Trump promised that he was going to do, right? This was one of his campaign promises. He had a very busy first week issuing a lot of executive orders and actions, as well as kind of pushing through confirmation hearings or a couple of weeks. You know, what is your sense of this and the response to it?
Well, I think the first lesson here is we should believe Trump when he says he's going to do something, which, frankly, we weren't. I think a lot of people weren't sure how that was going to shake out. I know I said once or twice, oh, but when it comes down to it, is he really going to do thing X? And this thing X he's doing. The piece that I'm interested in is that I think Trump thinks what he just did was a compromise. Right. What's striking many people as an incredibly aggressive action that was only barely telegraphed, where there was no warning, where it doesn't appear to have been vetted through any of the relevant bureaucracies. Trump has said, you know, listen, I could have put a lot more countries on the list. I could have banned all refugees. That, you know, I am the executive. This is a power reserved to the executive. And frankly, I just took Obama's list, right? He said this. He said these seven countries were identified by my predecessor as the places where terrorists originate. And I'm just strengthening what were sort of pre-existing limits on travel from those nations. So, you know, the sort of gap between hashtag Muslim ban and protests in airports and what I suspect Trump perceives to have been, what I know Trump perceives to have been a compromise and a softer action than what he could have taken, does not bode well for any kind of consensus.
Right. And Rudy Giuliani, who is an advisor to him on some of these issues, has gone on the record saying, look, you know, he knew that he couldn't do a Muslim ban per se, which is one of the things he promised during his campaign. So he asked Rudy and some other people to come up with a way to make this legal. It remains to be seen. You know, there is no question that the chief executive does have certain powers to ban certain classes of people or from certain countries, aliens, I guess they're technically considered, although it's clear that any kind of religious test probably won't pass court muster. Matt, there obviously were tons of protests. There was a big one at JFK Airport. There was a big one at LAX that Reason TV covered. What is your sense of the reaction to this and how it is, you know, how is that going to matter to how this all plays out, both politically as well as kind of legally?
Well, there's a school of thought that Steve Bannon, whose fingerprints are all over this, has described himself in the past as a Leninist, like he wants to create chaos. And then from that chaos, we can steer things into a kind of radical new direction. I don't like to get too far into the brains of Trump administration and Trump himself. I think it's a way for them.
Lest you not be able to find your way out.
Yeah. I mean, don't let politicians live rent free in your head. The response to this from my point of view has been actually very affirming. I think if you're going to be focused on playing defense against the more authoritarian or illiberal aspects of a Trump administration, what you want to know is that there are all kinds of channels of civil society and institutions that stand ready to, at a moment's notice, obstruct or help. And we saw a lot of people just flood into airports and say, how can we help these people who are behind closed doors? And I would like to say, I have a little bit of experience with this. You know, my wife, excuse me, is French national and now a U.S. citizen, but she was a green card holder for a long time. And when you are a green card holder, or even when you're applying for a green card, coming into the country is a terrifying thing. You have to first apply for what's called advanced parole. They literally call it parole if you want to leave the country while your status is pending. And during that period of time, thanks to the Immigration Act that was signed in 1996, a Border Patrol guard or anyone, customs person, has your entire fate in their hands. They can stamp a screw you thing, do not entry for 5 years into your passport, and you have no legal recourse for review. So imagine traveling to and fro this country where that's already the state of play. And when you go into airports and you land, half the time, a third of the time during that process, my wife would be diverted into what we call the dark room, where people would go, excuse me again. And you don't know what's going to happen. And sometimes you're not allowed to use your cell phone. So, you know, these would last, you know, 3 hours, something like that. Imagine that's now 17 hours or 25 hours in the context of a president who has previously not only said that he was interested in a Muslim ban, but also that he was interested in deporting Syrian refugees who have already come to the United States. That has not been re-exhumed this past weekend, but that was a thing that he said during the campaign trail. So it's a pretty terrifying experience. And I was heartened by ACLU and other legal aid organizations rushing to airports and just people being sympathetic, saying, okay, hey, look, do these people need food? Can we go in there? So I think that's pretty healthy. The debate about this has smoked out, I think, a lot of interesting pathologies, including what I'll be writing about later on today, is the kind of apologetics on the in some conservative quarters of like reacting to it by saying, those liberals, they're always like a crying wolf here, you know, keeping your eye on the prize of policing the hyperbole of people who are opposing what are by even, sympathetic accounts, really a ham-handed and draconian move, I think speaks to how some people are going to adapt to the change in power in Washington, which is to say they're not going to adapt to it by a consistent application of principle against power.
Sadly. Well, we expect, a group like Breitbart to be full-throated in its support of anything that Trump does, because that's who they are and that's what they do. But it is true that this ban, which targets, everybody is saying it's not a Muslim ban. It just happens to be of seven countries, of people from seven countries that are Muslim majority, between 90% to 100% Muslim majority. But you see this in National Review and a bunch of other conservative publications that have always been anti-immigrant and have always looked at least in the 21st century, of all Arabs with a very suspicious eye, except for persecuted Christians. And it does seem that they're willing to say, well, you know what, like, yeah, Syrian Christians are getting massacred, but, you know, that's a price that we're willing to pay in order to maintain a ban on refugees who might be ISIS people in disguise. Catherine, do you think, how is this going to play out? I mean, on the heels of the Women's March, just a week or so ago, how is this going to play out in terms of hardening the liberal and kind of Democratic Party resistance to everything that Trump does?
I think that resistance is already pretty darn hardened. My question is kind of, when do we reach an outrage maximum? And, Trump has shown that he can, and I hate this phrase, but let's go ahead and use it, dominate the news cycle. He's extremely good at that. And while everyone is freaking out over the daily shifting ground on this ban on travel from these suspect countries, and rightly so, they're also not playing the long game. And I do think that's by design. I mean, it's true that this is the biggest deal, but the wall is also pending. The defunding of sanctuary cities is also pending, and that's just in the immigration sphere.
Right. Yeah, because there's a Supreme Court nomination that is, it's been announced, is going to be made, or is rumored to be made, to Tuesday at 8 p.m.
Right. So the fact that it's just like bam, bam, bam every day. I do think that while, of course, Matt is right that it's incredibly heartening to see people sort of flooding to the airport, I'm already starting to get this feeling of like activists just running from location to location shouting. And I think the people who are trying to play the long game, though I am mostly just sympathetic to people who are saying, at this point, we're fully in opposition. I do think there are some people, some of these apologists, you could read them as, anti-Arab, anti-Muslim, racist, anti-immigrant types. But some people are still trying to look for a deal. I'm right now at an immigration event at the Microsoft offices hosted by Reason's Chick Adalmia. And, there are people here who are still saying, all right, but we got to keep our eye on expanding H-1Bs. We got to keep our eye on a guest worker program. These are places we could still snatch. Victory is way too strong a word, but we could still get some wins because Trump isn't actually an isolationist. He just is playing this issue heavily on the terrorism card, heavily on the security card. So, you know, I like the rage. I'm always up for rage, but I'm worried about rage exhaustion.
Yeah. So, you know, there's also this larger question from a specifically libertarian point of view. How do you deal, how do you factor in something like this, which I think all three of us agree, Muslim, not Muslim ban, which is not going to particularly have any positive effect in terms of making the country safer than it is. Refugees are not a security threat. They're already vetted extremely well. It is, according to the U.S. Embassy in Iraq, it's already the ban is creating a kind of minor move towards ISIS in Iraq because people are like, what the fuck? You know, it's like America is screwing us over again. You know, so it seems to be in many ways to be counterproductive on the ground in other countries. But what, you know, how are libertarians supposed to deal with things like this? You know, because at the same time that Trump is doing something here that's is totally anathema to any kind of libertarian position on immigration, on foreign policy, on a wide variety of issues of tolerance and openness. You know, he also is talking about deregulating certain aspects of industry. His school, his education secretary, Betsy DeVos, who has her issues, is a is the strongest proponent of school choice ever to be, you know, considered for Secretary of Education. Things like that. Matt, you know, what is the way that the libertarian resists Trump, but also does not simply say, you know, to hell with him. And I'm totally against him no matter what, because in a way, we're not, you know, we didn't vote for Trump. We didn't vote for Hillary Clinton. What we want is a freer world. How do we work around Trump? And on other issues, how do we work around a Democratic minority in Congress or a Republican majority in Congress to get the, to that, you know, to get to a more promised land of a little bit more free minds and free markets?
Well, one thing that we laid out in our book, Nick, The Declaration of Independence, How Libertarian Politics Can Fix What's Wrong with America, is that the future of politics is going to be more, and also the better strategy of politics is going to be more oriented around a purely issue by issue consideration of things. And if you detach from partisan loyalty and just treat things on issue by issue, it gets you. You're going to have a lot of temporary coalitions. That's how it works. And those temporary coalitions will include, on occasion, being in coalition with a president that you're otherwise opposing on other issues.
Do you think that's what's really happening, though? I mean, it seems like that was a good diagnosis in the pre-Trump era, but isn't the Women's March and the Muslim, you know, Ban Muslim March, and these are anti-Trump people. These are people who are not creating ad hoc coalitions. They're creating a permanent anti-Trump coalition.
Nick's question was about a libertarian approach. I won't speak for how Democrats should live their lives at this moment here. Libertarian approach is, I mean, there was a statement from our friend Brian Hooks over as speaking for the Koch Network. I think this morning they had a big retreat, the annual retreat in Palm Springs, and they came out pretty strongly against the executive order on refugees and things like that. At the same time, while acknowledging that there are many areas in which they're going to be able to do business with the Trump administration. That sounds to me totally the right kind of approach. Rand Paul is a big critic of the Trump administration on a lot of ways, and he's also writing at least one version of the what will probably be the Trump repeal and replace for Obamacare. You see this among a lot of people. Justin Amash was probably one of the first people to come out of the gate criticizing this executive order. You know, he will also presumably praise the Betsy DeVos's of the world out there. So I think that's just to the normal. We don't have to. I think there's this tendency in American life and in politics in particular to say, are you with us or are you against us? We saw this during the Tea Party. Are you with the Tea Party or against it? Are you with Occupy Wall Street or are you against it? It's like, yeah, I'm with some of it and I'm against some of it. And we'll have these conversations. And that's our job as both, you know, inside outsiders, is to engage people in conversations, to tell our Democratic friends who are in pure full oppositions remind them, hey, there's a strategic opportunity here. If you are trying to, say, oppose Jeff Sessions, which they are trying to do, you're going to need to peel off some Republicans. Here are some arguments that might work with these libertarian leading Republicans who have libertarian objections to Jeff Sessions. So I think that's what our role is. You don't have to spend every time answering the single meta question, you know, is this person good or evil? I have my own suspicions about that, but they're irrelevant. I want to work on a case by case.
Catherine,
basis.
Do you think it's possible to create, either an ad hoc coalition or issue by issue coalitions that peel off people? So, for instance, with something like school choice, to the extent that African American voters are a solid and reliable bloc for the Democratic Party, typically voting more than 90% in favor of whatever Democratic candidate is running in any election, but they're big believers in school choice. They have higher than average embrace of school choice. Is there a way to present, kind of voting blocks like that with the libertarian position on something in a way that gets them to think about things issue by issue? Because it is true that the tribal allegiances here are pretty strong, and for good reason. I mean, that's the way politics work. And even if fewer of us identify as Democrats or as Republicans, it's exactly in moments like this where, as you were suggesting, you know, where you become a total never-Trumper, an anti-Trumper in, you know, root and branch. So is there, you know, do you think it's viable to peel people off depending on the issue?
I want to live in that world. I think we sometimes live in that world. But my suspicion is that particularly if this fast and furious pace keeps up in the first 100 days or what have you of the Trump administration, that at some point the true Trump oppositionists will consider dissent, will consider any kind of coalition building with Trump to be evidence of non-trustworthiness, and that they sort of won't want to let occasional allies into the coalition and vice versa. I think Trump has a particular way of hardening the shells around some of these coalitions in a way that isn't good for libertarians. And I think it's still our obligation to say he's doing this thing that's good and this thing that's bad. And I actually think it's possible that Trump really is chaotic neutral rather than chaotic evil. But mm-hmm. I think the willingness of others to let us libertarians hop in and out of their coalitions according to our principles might be reduced in the era of Trump.
I tend to agree with you, and it's kind of depressing, but it remains our true objective at Reason and among, I think, small L libertarians in general, in the sense, you know, Trump's rejection of what he called globalism or globalization, that's a kind of comes out of the globalism that he rejected, but when he would tar Hillary Clinton as a globalist, meaning that she would put other countries or the world's interests first, which doesn't actually strike me as an accurate description of Hillary Clinton, but it may be an accurate description of libertarianism. One of the reasons why I'm a libertarian is because I believe in something approaching universal human rights. I believe in respect for and an understanding of individual cultures and local cultures and traditions. I also recognize very strongly the ability or the inability and the lack of omnipotence of America as a country, certainly as a government, to fix all the problems in the world. But there is, very central to my understanding of libertarianism, this idea that we are all humans and that we have basic rights, including the right of exit, voice, and loyalty. And it seems to me that Trump is very much diametrically opposed to that in almost everything he does, even when his specific policy positions tend to line up pretty well with libertarianism in issues such as school choice and certain types of regulatory issues. Matt, do you think, there will definitely be issues that we can work, with Republicans on, and there may be some for Democrats, but what is the frame that we should be presenting to people? Because we're also playing a long game here of, it's not about partisan politics. It's about the general larger direction of the country. And, you know, Trump's, the executive order about immigrants and refugees is of a piece with his general immigration policies, with his trade protectionism, with the way he talks about America first. Is there, you know, what is the frame that we need to be presenting people that will, you know, actually, you know, make more sense longer, further down the road, rather than just talking about control of Congress or this or that particular issue?
I think the question touches on the overall correct analysis of the global political moment that we live in which the main tension is between Davos man and anti-Davos man. And Trump represents this. The Bannonite kind of wing represents this. The National Front in France, parties in, at this point, a dozen European countries, parties that run countries like Hungary and whatnot, they are explicitly against any kind of transnational, international grouping. Things like Brexit kind of point at this. And the challenge will be, I believe, and I'm very open to being wrong about this, I believe that as flawed as the kind of internationalist post-World War II vision has been, that has been for reducing tariffs globally and to create international kind of structures for integration as a way, as a means of spreading peace and a bulwark against authoritarianism. I think that the new reality, which is gaining steam and which has all the momentum on its side towards sovereignty and kind of anti-transnational structures, I think the new thing is going to be much less friendly towards our overall belief system and values than the old system, as flawed as the old system was. So trying to influence the new thing as into a more friendly direction is part of our task, but so is, you know, kind of correctly, I think, analyzing where we're at. And there is very, very little to suggest that the new trends are going to be interested in actual liberal capitalism. And that is incredibly problematic and has from the beginning consistently been my biggest worry about the incoming Trump administration, the prospects of it. He has been so consistent about this over time, even before he became a presidential candidate, that these are his values. Those values, for the most part, are anathema to ours. So yes, case by case, but also recognize that larger frame.
You know, Catherine, there's also a version of this kind of tribalism on the left, at least in the domestic left in America, when identity politics rears its head and says, you know what, we're not talking about, you know, kind of civil rights era liberal values where everybody should be treated the same, but rather as we identify more and more with smaller and smaller, more and more distinct minority groups, whether they're gender-based, whether they're sexual, whether they're, you know, ethnic or racial, you know, it's a black thing, it's a this thing, it's a that thing. Or you saw some of this in the Women's March where it was, okay, white, upper middle-class women, you're at the back of the bus this time around because this is about women of color. It's about people who have specifically even more difficult times getting by in the world. So you see kind of a breakup of that universal ideal of equality and of freedom. Does it trouble you, or do you think, is this something that is more, maybe more vocal, but is actually not growing in size and represents a relatively small number of people in the United States?
I wonder if there's a version of this story where Trump is actually a force that forestalls the fragmentation of this coalition on the left. If, you know, if we're just busy actually opposing someone who wants to ban Muslims from entering or leaving or freely moving across the U.S. borders, you know, maybe people don't actually have time to fight about whether or not a poster that says "Get your government out of my uterus" is a hate crime against trans people. I think there's a possibility that actually it could force some prioritization, because I do think even people who are really in the trenches on these identity politics wars are typically motivated by these kind of larger principled concerns. So I think it could be actually that some of those distinctions erode. At the same time, I wonder if, again, the sort of protest fatigue starts to mean that instead of a large permanent coalition against Trump's, you know, what people would perceive as his racist tendencies, they break down into defending their own group in what they perceive as a time of crisis. I, of course, like Matt's version of, well, we're not defending in-group versus out-group. We're defending a global order that is characterized by free trade and free movement of peoples. It's tough to put that on a poster, though.
Yeah, and it's also true that historically, I mean, the big mass protest movements have been against very specific things, whether it was civil rights for blacks or against the Vietnam War. I mean, they were not, and we saw this with the Tea Party, the minute that it moved away from a very tight focus on spending to immigration, to national defense, et cetera, it started to dissipate even after it had elected a bunch of people to office. I wonder as well that the, you know, one of the things that I find kind of ironic about American opponents of Muslims coming here, and I, you know, this fills everybody's Twitter feed, your Facebook feed, the nightly news and whatnot, where people will say, you know, and Matt, having lived in Europe, I think you might be particularly well placed to talk about this, but they'll say, you know, like these Muslims are ideologically committed. They're theologically committed to the death of the West. They hate tolerance. They hate freedom, et cetera. And they'll point to the European experience with Muslim ghettos and Muslim refugees and terrorism. And they never point to the way in which Muslims in America, who make up less than 1% of the population, have actually assimilated incredibly well in places like Dearborn, Michigan and Hamtramck, Michigan, which are the two biggest, most Muslim jurisdictions in the country. They have Muslim city councils, and they even have, you know, American football teams and things like that. There's no problem there. What is it about people who, on the one hand, seem to be demanding that we, you know, bow down in front of American exceptionalism in every speech that every politician gives in any circumstance, and yet they refuse to acknowledge one of the great and unique things about America is that it pretty much assimilates all comers into what we consider an American identity without many problems whatsoever?
I mean, let's point out the obvious context to your, I think, very correct and shrewd question, but is that, you know, we're in a long struggle with Islamic extremism and terrorism, and Islam's going through a thing. And if there is a big terrorist attack in this country, chances are pretty good that there's someone who is at least trying to affiliate with radical Islam. So people are bent out of shape and worried about that for reasons that are totally understandable. But you're right that it's this terrible irony in which the Trump coalition is pointing to Europe and saying, see, that's what we're doing. And it's not what we're doing. In fact, by their actions, we are becoming more like Western Europe. And that's a bad thing, which is to say that Western Europe is not particularly great at assimilating Muslims, assimilating any others out there. You know, England and France and Germany are, and arguably Switzerland, are kind of at the good end of that scale, but they all have their very serious troubles doing that. Europe is mostly a bunch of nation states where you know what a German looks like, you know what a French person looks like, and you treat anyone who's outside of that normality different. And you also have a welfare state, which is much more kind of omnipresent than what we have here, and kind of smothering, particularly to immigrants, to young people, to people who in America are more likely to be creating businesses. It's harder to do that there. So the policies that the Bannonites want to enact here would make us more like that. So it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And there's also a conflation here, it really distresses me to see that a lot of the insight behind the Trump executive order was based on his constant mischaracterizations during the campaign, and then the broader mischaracterizations that you see on the restrictionist right, saying that the refugee population in Europe is like the refugee population in the United States. It's not. we don't have a majority of military-aged males coming through the Syrian refugee program. We don't. The majority of our refugees from Syria, slim majority, but a majority nonetheless, have been women folk. It's harder to get here. When you go through the process, they are cognizant of the military-aged males problem. So there's a lot of cruel ironies associated with all of this. And I hope, think about not just Dearborn, Michigan, where people are more recent. They're probably a little bit more. Think about Beverly Hills, for crying out loud. Westwood, Reseda, where I come from in Southern California. These are not only thriving communities of people who probably have more money than the people I grew up with in a prosperous middle class suburb in Southern California, but they also became the center of resistance to the mullahs in Iran. Who do you think is fucking broadcasting anti-mullah stuff into Iran? It's the Persians who you just targeted, asshole. It's amazing to me the bass-ackwardness of it. The people that we accept as refugees not only become more fervent as American patriots, but they become the people who are essentially the exile community who are against the idiots who run the countries that we don't like. So this is it's very much shooting ourselves in the foot. I just recommend everyone getting in touch with your friends who are Iranian American, many of whom have been Republican over the years, and listening to what they're talking about right now. They're completely bewildered.
There's also a conflation between the Mexican rapists and the Syrian terrorists, right? The idea that those two tiny, 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 yet admittedly problematic populations can be dealt with in the same way, or that they're even part of the same problem, is a big issue here. You know, by trying to build a sieve that filters those very diverse types of people, and also, by the way, everyone who might take an American job, it's not a sieve anymore, right? It's just a wall.
Maybe that door Trump had talked
about.
It's
a big, beautiful door.
But maybe that door is getting smaller and smaller. Well, we will leave it here. We have been talking with Catherine Mangan Ward. She's the editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine. Catherine, thanks for talking.
Thank you.
And Matt Welch, he's the editor-at-large at Reason. Matt, thank you for talking.
Dankeschön.
And this has been the Reason Podcast. I am Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes, rate and review us while you're there. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll talk to you again real soon.